Thanks very much. Well, thanks for the opportunity to come and speak here this evening. My name's Sam Cockerell. I'm Business Development Manager with Ensys, and I'm going to tell you about what we do, a bit about the business, and about the grain biorefining industry, which is the type of business we are, and how, through that industry and our activities, we contribute both to greener fuel supplies and also to greener food supplies. Just a bit of background on what Ensys is, where we've come from first. You may not have heard of Ensys, and that's not surprising. We're a fairly young company. In fact, 5 years ago, we didn't exist. The company was set up in 2006, and it was set up in response to the challenges of energy security and climate change. It's a fairly massive undertaking, what we're doing. We're constructing a plant in the Northeast, or we've been constructing a plant in the Northeast. It's now in operation. That plant represents about £300 million worth of private sector investment in the region into the UK. It's a very, very significant piece of investment that's gone in, without any significant public sector support. This is really a very strong piece of green growth news here. We support something like 2,000 jobs throughout the supply chains that serve the plant and take our co-products out. So we're clearly a part of the economic growth story as well. We're a part of green growth. This picture on the right-hand side here, this is the plant in 2008 as it was being built. And you can see the scale of these things. That pixel there is a bloke. So these vessels and the bits of kit on the plant are truly colossal. As I say, we are operational now. We're a world-scale grain biorefinery. We use UK-sourced animal feed wheat. And we produce enough bioethanol to meet over half of UK demand. So we are, in the UK context, a very significant player. As plants go, we're one of the largest bioethanol-producing plants in Europe. And that bioethanol is produced with a very good carbon saving. It's very green bioethanol. We save about 70% of the greenhouse gas emissions that would otherwise be produced by the gasoline that we replace on a direct basis. What's less well known about Ensys is we're also one of Europe's largest producers of animal feed. And because of that, we don't typically describe ourselves as a bioethanol producer, although we do produce bioethanol. We call ourselves a biorefiner, and there's an important distinction. Let me explain what I mean by biorefining. What I've shown here on a per hectare basis is the feedstock that we use. We use animal feed wheat. It's about 10 or 11% protein. It also contains about two-thirds of the mass here is in the form of starch and sugars, mostly fermentable plant materials. It also contains fibre, oil, various other bits and pieces. What we do with that in the plant, which is very similar in terms of the technology to a whiskey distillery, we take the grains, we mash them up, we add enzymes, and we run them through a fermentation process which converts the vast majority of these starch and sugars into bioethanol and carbon dioxide. Now that reaction, that fermentation reaction, is actually remarkably efficient. It doesn't waste any energy. We're not creating heat in the process of doing this. About 95% of the biomass energy in starch and sugars is concentrated directly into the biofuel. So this is a pretty useful way of concentrating biomass energy up into a useful fuel form. The carbon dioxide, which is sort of just released by the reaction stoichiometry, is released in pure form. So this comes off the top of the fermenter, and we tap it, we send it off to Yara, and they compress it and turn it into liquid form. And that's then used in food production, in fizzy drinks, in horticulture, and various other industrial uses. But the interesting point about the carbon dioxide is we capture it on a fairly large scale, but it's a very low-cost capture operation, right? We're not separating it from water vapour and other flue gases, as you would have to if you were capturing carbon from a coal power station. And therefore, in future, when the UK has an industrial carbon capture and storage infrastructure, it's likely, we believe, that plants like the Ensys biorefinery will be able to contribute on a fairly cost-effective basis to that carbon storage infrastructure. This is low-cost, biogenic carbon capture. Now, what's left over, everything else that hasn't gone out the door in the form of ethanol or carbon dioxide, goes out as animal feed. It's called DDGS, which is a fairly nondescript term. It stands for distillers, dried grains with solubles. And as I've shown here, this is basically everything else. We don't produce any waste. We don't produce an effluent. This is the leftover material after this has taken place. But this is a particularly useful material. So this isn't just a byproduct or a residue, this is a critical part of the plant's economics and sustainability. And the reason for that is here. The protein which is produced in the animal feed wheat that comes into the plant is entirely disregarded by the yeast as it goes through fermentation. In fact, the yeast actually add to the protein in the crop. They add, they assimilate a certain amount of nitrogen that's added to the process. So what goes out the door is slightly more protein than what comes in. But because we've taken away the starch, the sugars here, what we're left with is a 30 or 40%, say around 35% protein content, animal feed. This is a high protein animal feed. And the usefulness of this is in feed diets in Europe, we need high protein components to feed animals so they put on weight fast enough to be economically viable as a livestock industry. So this co-product adds to European and global supplies of high protein animal feed. And it competes, you know, on its merits in the marketplace on a market-defined price. And that is our feed co-product. The reason it's so important for sustainability, for sustainability reasons, is set out here. So I've kind of copied the chart I showed on the previous page on the right-hand side. What I've compared this wheat DDGS to is the composition of soy meal. Okay? So in Europe, we import quite a lot of soy meal. And just by way of context, soy meal is an animal feed. We use this for our livestock industry. The livestock industry globally is responsible for about a fifth of global greenhouse gas emissions. And a lot of that is because of the food production, the feed production that's required, and the land area that's required to make animal feed that goes into the livestock chain. Now, Europe has a very large demand for high-protein feed ingredients as part of its compound feed diets, but it's around 70% dependent on imports to meet that requirement. For me, this is a remarkable statistic. In Europe, we import about 35 million tonnes of soy meal. That's equivalent, the area that's grown on is equivalent to around 70% of the wheat area inside Europe. So for every 10 hectares of wheat grown inside of Europe, there's 7 hectares of soybeans grown outside of Europe for us. And I find that remarkable, particularly given that 90% of this is grown in South America, where there's deforestation pressures. So we are guilty here, I think, of adding pressure to a part of the world where land use change pressures are already quite intense. Now, there's another way of producing a high-protein feed ingredient with the sort of levels of protein that animals need, and that is to produce what we can make in Europe economically, which is this relatively low-protein ingredient, and then to concentrate it up by sucking out the extra starch and sugars. And you'll notice here that the protein produced, again, this axis is protein dry weight per hectare, the protein produced per hectare from feed wheat is pretty similar. It's about 0.8 or 0.9 of a tonne per hectare. It's pretty similar to what soy meal does. It's just feed wheat carries on after it's laid down that protein, stacking up all of this additional biomass energy. It's a phenomenally efficient crop, but we can't use it in pure form as a high-protein animal feed because it's too dilute. Biorefining converts this feedstock, which we can produce economically in Europe, into an animal feed that can replace soy meal. It's a more efficient use of land. And as a result, it reduces global deforestation pressures. So that's the greener animal feed. The greener transport fuel is another story. And we've talked about good and bad biofuels. It's very clear that not all biofuels are the same. And the Renewable Energy Directive differentiates on a direct basis between good and bad biofuels. NSERS, the biofuel we produce, fully complies with the carbon sustainability requirements in the RED. We sail over the 35% greenhouse gas saving requirement. We also, in fact, we are, I think we save about 70%, 70 or 80% of greenhouse gas emissions versus petrol. So we're well ahead of even the 2017 requirement when that goes up to 50% saving. But in addition, it's you can differentiate biofuels between good and bad on an indirect basis, and that's increasingly important. Most of the studies that are looking at indirect effects at the moment recognise that this is a difficult thing to evaluate, and the methodology for evaluating this is still under development. But those studies that recognise differences between different biofuels and their indirect effects, their indirect risks, recognise that the risks of indirect land use change from grain refining are relatively low compared to a lot of other biofuel pathways. So we produce a biofuel which has a very good carbon footprint. It has relatively low risk indirect effects. And if you add those carbon savings to the carbon savings on the food side, you see that we save around about 1 million tonnes of carbon per year. And that's actually fairly equally split between the carbon savings on the animal feed side and the carbon saving on the petrol side, on the biofuel side. I'm getting signs to hurry up, so I'm going to wind up. This is a study done by the Renewable Energy Association in 2009. If we accept that grain refining is potentially a good thing to do, it begs the question, is there actually enough grain to do it? And I'm going to skip through this slide fairly quickly. But the conclusion here is if you look at the supply which exists in Europe, the average of supply over the course of a five-year period, 2002-2006, and you add on the expected growth of yield and the use of a proportion of idle land in Eastern Europe, and you net from that total supply the current demand, the expected increase in demand, you're left with a relatively doable block here, which is what you'd need to convert, 37 million tonnes you'd need to convert to meet our 10% biofuel obligation in petrol. Now, that leaves a further 70 million tonnes, which we could, in theory, produce in Europe, which isn't required to meet the 10%, but which would allow us to go beyond that. So the sum total of this slide says that actually we could meet our 10% obligation with bioethanol in petrol without putting undue pressure on agriculture in Europe. And in fact, we could go well beyond that. My final slide is on first and second generation technology. And the point I would make here is that first generation bioethanol industry is not a dead-end industry which needs to make way for a second generation industry as and when the technology permits. It is an enabler for the development and the deployment of those second generation technologies. Now, second gen is clearly important, and I think most people would accept if we want to go beyond about 10 or 20% of global transport fuels, we need to look beyond first generation biofuels. There simply isn't enough easily fermentable starch and sugar around to make enough bioethanol to go much beyond that. So we need to start looking into the other plant components beyond this sort of easy to access starch and sugars that are very easily fermentable. The more complex plant carbohydrates, we look at hemicellulose, other non-starch polysaccharides, cellulose and lignin, the structure of those polymers and the way they're bound up in the plant makes them quite difficult to access. But in a first-generation plant, we have the advantage that they're already there. We've already produced the crops, we've transported them to the plant, we've put them in the pots and pans of the plant, and if we have the right technology in terms of pretreatment and the right technology in terms of enzymes, it's possible for us to begin to access energy from fractions up here. And it gets progressively more expensive the further along this sort of difficulty axis you go. But the first generation industry provides a platform for the development of technologies here, which in the future, as we look to other feedstock pathways, other types of agriculture to make grassy feedstocks or woody energy crop feedstocks, those tools will be deployable in those other supply chains. Very good. I'm getting frustrated messages, so my final slide. In conclusion, grain biorefining provides an immediate and sustainable contribution to UK and EU climate change targets and a greener food supply chain. This is food and fuel. We're improving food and energy security because we're adding to global supplies of high-protein animal feed as well as transport fuel. And the first-generation industry is a platform for technology development and commercialisation, so it's a source and future of green growth. Thanks very much.